Rada D'Souza is a researcher, social justice activist, and writer currently based in New Zealand. Most of her life experiences relate to India, where she was a public interest lawyer, researcher, democratic rights and labor activist, columnist, and freelance writer. Rada has worked in Asia-Pacific action networks and campaigns, locally and internationally. I had the opportunity to sit down with Rada for an interview on a variety of subjects. Given the recent World Social Forum in India and the counter-event called Mumbai Resistance, which Rada participated in, the interview focuses on the relationship between capitalist globalization, non-governmental organizations, NGOs, and international institutions such as the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization, WTO. The interview also addresses social movements in India and increased governmental repression post-September 11th, while making ties to increased repression against social movements throughout the world since 9/11.
How do we understand social movements? First of all, let's make it clear that social movements have not come with Seattle or with anti-globalization movements. All societies throughout history, wherever there is repression, wherever there is injustice, people have fought. And when people fight, we call it social movements. So it is not as if globalization has suddenly created social movements. Now, in doing that, people conceptualize the problems. People conceptualize who their enemies are. People conceptualize what is liberation. People conceptualize how they want to emancipate themselves, And people are, all human beings are thinking beings. We all, think and analyze and understand that. Now, in that conceptualization, for me, dependency becomes political dependency when, for the very concepts to conceptualize their own problems, they have to depend on concepts from others. When they are able to conceptualize their own problems, then they are independent and autonomous. And that is the difference between self-determination and between, what you call other kinds of movements. Now, one has to go back a little bit on how did these new social movements come about. Just let's go a little bit step back and look at the history. In 1995, there was the UN Human Development Conference in Copenhagen. And sometimes I think politicians, because of their stupidity or inadvertently, or maybe occasionally they speak the real truth, but they say things that reflect exactly what they're thinking about. It's like, for example, when Bush said, "If you are not with us, you are against us." I mean, it was a moment of truth, because that is the reality of today's politics. If you're not with them, you are against them, So in the same vein, Clinton made a statement at the 1995 Copenhagen meeting or the UN summit on human development. And he said, "We are not going to give any aid to these third world states anymore. We are going to divert all our aid through civil society organizations." And since then, and you'll find that, of course, he said it, but that agenda has been things. He only said it explicitly in a moment of off guard. Later on, of course, he qualified it, and all his PR people came and they said, public relations, they said, "No, that's not what we meant," and whatever. But that is what has been happening with neoliberalism and with globalization. A lot of assistance that used to go to developing countries through multilateral, bilateral mechanisms are now cut back. For example, I will give you a concrete example of a program that I was associated with in my state in Maharashtra, and as a lawyer, of course, because I have defended, groups from community groups on that. This used to be called the Integrated Rural Development Program. Now, the Integrated Rural Development Program was a program that set up in rural areas what you call rural centers. And it was like a one-stop center for rural communities where they got a whole range of services. There was a primary health, there was women, you know, women's health, then prenatal, postnatal care, then there was creche. So it was a kind of multi-thing. And a large number of rural women also got employment because of part-time, casual employment that they could coordinate with their domestic and other responsibilities. And the money for this used to come through the federal government, through bilateral and multilateral aid. Then, with the whole neoliberalism, the government stopped getting that money. The government closed down these programs because they said, we are not getting the money anymore, right? Now, instead, what happened, a lot of NGOs started getting funding for setting up all sorts of rural poverty elimination programs and all sorts of things. Now, the question I want to ask you, Stefan, is, as a citizen, okay, against my government, I have rights. I can tell my government, I need a community welfare thing here. I need healthcare center here. You have to do this.
Yes.
Yeah? With an NGO, I have no rights. I can't demand from an NGO, you have to set up a primary health center in my village.
Exactly.
And this is a fundamental difference. And yet, the NGOs operate on the basis of empowerment. They say they are coming to empower us, but they are taking away our empowerment. We had fundamental rights, constitutional guarantees against our government, right? Now, of course, the government will say, we were able to set up those centers and facilities because of money from, you know, multilateral assistance. But that's their problem. That is for the governments to sort out, you know, and to negotiate and to this thing. But as a citizen, why should I have to forego my rights for right to livelihood, right to, you know, life, and have to depend on making applications and getting somebody to come and do that? So that's a fundamental difference. Yeah. Now, with that then, I come back to the question that you raised on solidarities, therefore. So social movements have always been there. They will always be there wherever there is injustice. Which ones do you want to support? That's the question. And that's a choice that you need to make. Do you want to make support groups, people who are fighting injustice and who want self-determination and who want to assert their idea of what is emancipation? Or do you want to support groups which concur with your ideas here in Canada or in US or wherever about what constitutes justice? See, and that is where you have to make. And it's a difficult choice because I'm thinking, if I were a Canadian, what would I do? And again, we all, you know, view the world from where we stand. If you have a certain concept of what is gender justice or what is, you know, environmental justice, you will think the whole world is like that or should be like that, right? But it may not be like that. And that is where your genuine liberalism, if you like to call it, of your genuine ability to accommodate different views comes in. But I have a very simple understanding of solidarity, and which is, I think, a working definition of solidarity, if you like. If there are people who are fighting for justice in their own societies, you're fighting in your society for justice here, and I'm fighting for mine in my place, then we can come together and say, do we have some things in common, and can we work out some common grounds? Now, that is solidarity. But when you don't do anything in your Canadian society and you start talking about Africa and Asia and somewhere else, then I don't think that is solidarity. Yeah, that is evangelism in a new form.
Yeah. In terms of what you've just addressed, you must have certain perceptions of terms like democracy, human rights, international development. As you described non-governmental organizations, NGOs, from what you said, it almost seems like NGOs are playing a very strong role in the globalization process, in the corporate globalization or capitalist globalization process. It's part of that same movement. Rather than a solidarity between movements, they are forcing themselves on communities, on societies. So for somebody in Canada, a nation which presents itself as respecting these terms or these ideas, you know, what's your perception of Canada as coming from that background with that critique of NGOism and globalization and so on?
My question to democracy, I mean, I must say that I have been a long-standing participant in democratic movements in India. In the post-emergency period, we set up the Committee for Protection of Democratic Rights. We have been, you know, part of that. But I think that Western societies need to do a bit of self-reflection and introspection. It's always easy to talk about others. It's very difficult to talk about yourself. And that's the case both as human beings and as societies. It's very easy to talk about this one is good, that one is bad, but very difficult to talk about yourself. And I think that there is need to do that. And a fundamental question for democracy today, and as in the past, is you cannot have democracy in a colonial imperialist setup, because that you cannot have the two together, because democracy means a world without imperialism, a world without colonization, and that is the only consistent way of being democratic. Now it seems to me that that is where the capacity and the ability to reflect and introspect gets lost, and there seems to be an assumption that we can be democratic and be colonial and be imperialist at the same time. And that is why I have real concerns about this whole human rights agenda and how that is interpreted. Because what the human rights movement in the West, and we talked about conceptualizing before this, and would be a good example of that. In the West, the human rights movement conceptualizes human rights as individual abuses by the state on individuals. So it's always about individual rights. But why does a state have to engage in repression? And that is something that we don't seem to ask ourselves. But if you went down that path and if you asked, why are these individuals being abused, then you will have to confront with the struggles of the people there, with the questions of social justice there, and there are reasons why repression happens. But in India, I can definitely say for India, for example, we have never subscribed to human rights. We have always talked about democratic rights and democratic movements, because that brings the whole context for human rights violation into perspective. And we have always believed that you must respect the right of communities to assert themselves and to do what they want. That's a different conceptualization of rights from the human rights thing. And same thing with development. I mean, you talk about development. Now, it seems to me that the way the development is defined is only in economic terms. Development means having food, clothing, shelter to a certain extent or whatever. Another variant of how development is conceptualized is that the whole world should live like Western societies. Now that it is a very good life, it is very comfortable, there is a lot of more food, clothing and shelter than you really need. But is that development? Because again, if you self-reflect and if you introspect, where did this money come from? And that is where history becomes important. Because this development is based on land from indigenous people, on labor of developing countries, on their environmental resources, and that is how it comes up. Yet, the myth of development is sold to the third world as if it is possible to have capitalism without colonies. Now, there could not have been capitalism without colonies. It is as simple as that. And you don't need to be a great economist to realize this. My grandmother would have told you this. But yet, what is implicit in the whole development discourse is you can become, all third world countries can become capitalist countries if they only tried hard. Yeah? And that is where we say, we conceptualize it differently. We say, no, your capitalism and your wealth and all that has come out of our land, our labor, our resources. We can't colonize anybody, so we can't become capitalists. So we just have to find a different way of doing this.
Yeah. What do you see as the reaction of grassroots social movements in India to this crisis that you're talking about? In terms of a rejection of this neocolonialism and also, of course, the history of absolute colonialism, what is the response?
In India's case, because it is a big subcontinent and size matters, the response of Indian society has been twofold and completely opposite, depending on which society you're talking about. On the one hand, you have the middle classes, the property classes, who have benefited greatly because of the software revolution and because of all the economic and other ties. And they, for the first time, see a certain empowerment by being as part of this sort of global network of, you know, post-September 11 nations. And for the first time in post-independence Indian history, we are seeing a relationship between Israel, United States and India that is military, that is economic, and that has major implications for the region. And this is the first time, and I don't think that people are talking about it as much. And this is a very radical shift from India's positions on international affairs in the last 50 years. And that is because there is a section of Indian society who thinks that they are going to be part of the big league now. Yeah? And they want a power sharing in that. So that is one section. But there is also a section of Indian society which sees that this big league thing is going to mean more internal repression, is going to mean more communal strife, as you will see in Gujarat and things. Yeah? And because of this new international alliance that has come up, yeah, the alliance is used to put down social justice movements within India. For example, Gujarat. Had Gujarat happened 10 years ago, the whole world will be crying out on, you know, human rights and communal violence and whatever it is. But now that there is an alliance between a right-wing government and a, you know, and the US and Israel, so India, the right-wing government is able to get away with Gujarat. Nobody has even talked about. There's nothing, you know. So that is one part of the reality. The other part of the reality is, of course, the growing resistance to these things. We are seeing increasing farmers' movements rising, student movements becoming more. And interestingly, I think, and this is a difference, say, between the pre-90s India and the present India, social movements in India, these are all rural movements and they are all happening in remote places. They are not happening in Bombay and Calcutta and Delhi. They are all happening in... And so unless you actually reach out to those communities, you won't even know what's going on there. You know? For example, and that is why I said this increase in extrajudicial killings, it's not even talked about because it doesn't happen in Delhi or Bombay or Calcutta. Yeah. On the contrary, the Indians from the big cities, we find, are really now more than ever part of the international circuit of, you know, the educated liberal voices who come here and who speak about the poor and who speak about all that. But you won't hear many of them talking about extrajudicial killings. Yeah? Because that's only that's a different India. So there are two Indias. And a lot of things will depend on which India you want to see. And you can see one and not see the other at all if you choose to.
can you talk about, given this reality, right, and the rise of social movements, but then also the subsequent repression, that repression is happening around the world since this new war on terror. There's repressions against social movements, even in the very nations who have launched this war on terror. So maybe can you explain, from your perception, what are the terms in which we should view and support these social movements who are fighting for their very basic dignity or, you know, the basics of life to maintain their communities? But when they fight back and organize, how should we be viewing these movements?
Yes, I think it is important to actually identify the contributions that your societies are making to that state of affairs. So if we are talking about increased repression in India, if we are talking about communal violence in India, you know, I would say to you, I would request you, don't just say, oh, look at what is happening in Gujarat. You say, ask yourself, has our society, has Canada contributed in some way to that state of affairs? And when you try to make that connection between what your government implicitly, you know, explicitly is doing to bring about that situation, then you and I can say we are working in solidarity. Yeah, I think there is a tendency to always point to what is happening in other places as if these societies have no hand in it. Yeah, but the reality today is that none of the dictatorships in the third world would have been possible if it had not been because of the blessings of, you know, governments here. As I said, Gujarat, you know, with a different federal government would not have been possible.
Yes.
Because there would have been a big international hue and cry about it. Yeah, because there's a right-wing government that is pro-US, they can do whatever they like to people in India. So those are the kind of connections that you need to make.
You have been listening to an interview with Radha D'Souza, a researcher, social justice activist, and writer currently based in New Zealand. Most of her life experiences relate to India, where she was a public interest lawyer, researcher, democratic rights and labor rights activist, columnist, and freelance writer. Radha has worked in Asia-Pacific action networks and campaigns, locally and internationally. The interview focuses on the relationship between capitalist globalization, non-governmental organizations, NGOs, and international institutions such as the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization, WTO. The interview also addresses social movements in India and increased governmental repression post-September 11th, while making the ties to increased repression against social movements throughout the world since 9/11. To read articles written by Radha D'Souza, visit www.zmag.org. This interview was recorded and produced for CKUT Radio in Montreal by Stéphane Christophe.